This is Jim Hightower with my little pops of populism every single day, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Teresa Wilkie. The end of the year traditionally brings our panel of lawyers, David Bell and Robin Martinez, together to talk about the Supreme Court rulings, new laws, legislative actions, and cases of 2019 that will have a lasting effect on our lives. Tune in and see if you agree with who won and who lost. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. We want to give special thanks to our producer, Jeff Humfeld. Now to our panel of lawyers.
Good morning. This is Robin Martinez. I'm a local attorney. I'm joined this morning with David Bell. You are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. We are here this morning for our annual, it's actually becoming a tradition now, yes, review of the year in the law. We kind of cover a lot of the very important sort of Supreme Court decisions that came through over the last year. And I think we've got an interesting lineup this year. One thing I'd like to note right off the bat is that I think, and maybe you can comment on this too, David, is the last year was a little bit unusual because the Supreme Court actually had very few really big decisions. But then they actually filled their docket for the coming year with a large number of cases that I think have potentially great significance, given that they're going to fall in an election year. For instance, this coming year, the Supreme Court is going to decide cases involving really controversial issues such as abortion rights, separation of church and state, as well as, and this will be a fun one, the scope of presidential immunity from subpoenas.
Wow, that will be a good one. But, you know, it's interesting, Robin, when we talk about the importance of Supreme Court cases, these are the type of cases, even in the year we're going to talk about now, where only you and I and maybe three other people would know about them, could have really significant impact on people's lives. But because they don't touch on hot-button issues, nobody knows about them. But they will feel them, I guarantee. The cases we talk about today will be felt many years into the future.
Exactly. So why don't we take a dive into some of the, I think, more significant decisions that came down this year. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about the general split that we have on the Supreme Court between, you know, the more conservative justices that are now in the, you know, in a five majority over what is seen as the more traditionally liberal wing of the party. And, you know, let's focus maybe on what I thought was one of the more unusual decisions of the year, where you actually had a 9-0 decision on the Supreme Court, and that was in an area that I really did not expect, and it was one of civil asset forfeiture.
The case is Timms versus Indiana, and what it actually did was the court limited the ability of the police to seize private property. In case, you know, most folks don't know, the Constitution places limits on the ability of state and local governments to take and keep cash, cars, houses, and other property from people that they suspect might have committed a crime. And the interesting thing is over the years, civil forfeiture has been a really popular way by local police departments to raise money. And right, it is incredibly abusive. It's been the subject of a lot of criticism from both sides of the political spectrum. And what I think is going to happen is this court's decision is going to open some new legal arguments when the value of property that is being seized is way out of proportion to the crimes that are alleged to be involved. For instance, this particular case involved a guy by the name of Tyson Timms. He was a small-time drug offender in Indiana, and he pled guilty to selling about $225 worth of heroin to undercover police officers. So he was sentenced to a year of house arrest, 5 years of probation, and then I think he was ordered to pay something like $1,200 in fees and fines. Now, what happened, though, was the police then seized his Land Rover, which was worth about $42,000, and decided to keep it. And he had apparently bought this Land Rover with the proceeds of his dad's life insurance policy. And so the police seized it, saying that he had used this Land Rover in the commission of the crimes. And the Supreme Court then ruled that the Eighth Amendment, which bars excessive fines, limits the ability of the federal government to seize property. And so in this case, the court ruled that the clause also applied to the states under the 14th Amendment.
This is a big deal, a few things. And I've gotten a few of these cases and handled them. There's two parts to this. One is the disproportionate nature. And so if you have a legal asset like this car, it came from legal sources, but it touches upon something which is deemed illegal. Or let's say you have a bank account which is made supplied from income that you earned at your legal job, but in some cases proceeds, even minor, deposited in there. Does the whole thing become, quote, dirty, unquote, subject to seizure? That's one part. The second part, which I think a lot of people don't really realize, is that if you come to me as a lawyer and the police have seized something from you worth $5,000, do you want to pay me $10,000 to go get back $5,000? And so the reality is there's a large number of these forfeitures that go uncontested because no one wants to put good money after bad.
That makes a lot of sense. So you've actually seen a lot of civil asset forfeitures then as part of your practice here locally?
Correct. Because in some cases, which we've had on the federal side, you don't need necessarily criminal charges. A lot of times there's an underlying criminal action, but there doesn't necessarily have to be. And so you're fighting with individual agencies and you're fighting with the federal government. And the resources on the other side, if you will, are unlimited. And so that's where it comes into play. So if someone seizes, they seize $30,000 of cash in a trunk hidden in socks. I mean, so it was one where you look at it and you're like, well, God, that's a little bit unusual. But I guess if you've got $30,000 and it's in cash and it's yours, if you want to put it in your socks, you can. That being said, we did have to fight. We did get it back, but he had to use a pretty substantial part of it to get that back. And that's a significant risk, and a lot of people just don't want to do it. In addition, a lot of people don't want to take the risk of, in their minds, angering the government, so that if they're going to fight them on the civil side, that all of a sudden they're going to come back on the criminal side to hit them with something harder.
That does become a problem. But, you know, what's interesting, though, is that in my own experience, I don't practice criminal defense work. But a number of years ago, I had a colleague in an office that I worked at that did. And he had a very similar instance where a Latino couple was pulled over for the heinous act of driving while brown.
Wow.
And had $42,000 in a suitcase in the trunk of their car. And that was seized. The automatic presumption was, well, if you're carrying that much cash, it must be, you know, the proceeds of some illegal activity. But in that particular case, what had happened was it was an immigrant couple that didn't trust banks, and it was all the money that they had saved up to make a down payment on a house.
You know, it's that, you're right. I've seen that. And here's the fascinating part of that, and I think it's great that we explored on a station like 90.1. On the one hand, there's a group of individuals, it changes over time, groups of people that feel that they are outside of, and rightfully so, or have been pushed outside of the society for a variety of reasons, whether it could be discrimination, it could be whatever it is. And so they don't trust the system, and therefore they keep the cash that they legally earn on their person. When you and I look at it, I get an income from my law firm, it goes straight into my bank account, the government knows about it. But imagine if I were always felt myself on the outside of a system, I wouldn't trust it, I would want that money with me, I'd want it in my mattress. And the very being ostracized in that manner, at least feeling I am, brings about the very thing that causes the system to view my behavior as criminal. It's just an interesting kind of spiral, if you will.
That is. Well, to kind of full close the circle on this particular case, what I found interesting was the fact that it was a 9-0 decision on the part of the Supreme Court. And I kind of wonder that maybe what led to that unanimity was, on one hand, the liberal side of the bench taking a little bit more of a stringent view towards the police activity, and combined that with the more conservative members of the bench who tend to have a fairly strong emphasis on private property rights.
Correct.
So in my mind, I think the confluence of those two philosophies kind of came together in this particular case.
Well, and it is interesting. To the extent that they're wanting to protect private property, the conservative wing may be wanting to protect individuals that have a large amount of private property.
And so they were able to get the protection they wanted for those individuals by the seizure and forfeiture of a Land Rover.
So what would be proportionality in terms of El Chapo's material?
I'll bet you that was a big forfeiture amount.
So. So that was the first case we kind of covered. Did you have any particular cases, David?
I did. I wanted to give significant. I did. Thank you. I wanted to give an update. There was a case from it decided in 2018, Carpenter versus United States. And you know, it's interesting. You get up to the Supreme Court, we talk about winners and losers, and then but the reality is it generally is not decided at the Supreme Court, meaning some legal issues decided, but then they send it back, and essentially the Supreme Court's decision at the end will say, like, hey, lower court, just read what I've done here and apply it. That's essentially what they say in these cases. So in this case, Carpenter v. United States, this in 2011, so you can see, by the way, people talk about, well, if I don't win here, I'm going to appeal it. That is a bad idea generally to think in those terms, because if you're going to get to appeal it and if you're successful all the way on up, it may be a decade before you get somewhere. But in Carpenter, in 2011, police had arrested four men in a series of armed robberies. One of the men decided to turn, which happens often in federal cases, and provided a phone numbers for others. Based on that, the government went to essentially got a lower level, got a judge to demand from cell phone carriers location information from with regard to a certain phone number. Under the law at the time, it was a lower standard. It was not to the extent of a search warrant where you needed probable cause. So they got that information. The individual was convicted based on that location information, because it showed that he was with the others that were involved in these robberies, and he got over 100 years. So you can imagine, you get over 100 years, and in the feds, that means you're going to do over 100 years. There's no parole.
Well, that's a life sentence.
That's a life sentence. So you go up, it goes up on appeal, and the question is, do you need probable cause? Should it be a search warrant standard to get those cell phone records? The court says, you know what? Cell phone's very personal to all of us. We give up our location essentially with it. And the Supreme Court, it was actually a big case, because generally, if your information is out there to a third party, like bank records and other records, generally you have almost give up your right to privacy.
That diminished expectation.
Right, diminished. And here the court said, wait, that doesn't mean just because someone else knows about it that you have given up your complete right to privacy. And the court said, you know what, we need a search warrant here. Okay, so that's where we left off before. So then what happens is that the case then goes back down. So in June of 2019, and I spoke with the actual attorney that handled this, the trial and the appellate level, what eventually happened was the Sixth Circuit, rather than letting the case go down to the trial court to kind of redo the trial, the Sixth Circuit pulled the case and said, you know what? That's fine. You need a search warrant to get these phone records. But the police, when they got this under this lower standard, they did so in good faith. And so we're going to say that even though there was a mistake, the Supreme Court said you need a probable cause, because the police did it in good faith, we're going to allow those records in. And so could you imagine going up to the Supreme Court, getting the call that you've won, waiting a year? And I asked this attorney, how do you tell him? And he told me that he thinks they did it with Core Links, which is the email system for the feds. He had to tell the client that way, by email, that you win at the Supreme Court, which is like winning a lottery ticket, and you lose. So he's now doing over 100 years based on winning at the Supreme Court, but then losing at the Sixth Amendment. So just
wow. And so essentially the Sixth Circuit has now articulated a good faith exception.
Well, and so just, you know, they've relied on one that's existed before. If a search warrant is done in a manner where the police are essentially being honest about what they're saying, but there's a mistake in the process, there is a good faith exception to the search warrant. But in this particular case, it was fascinating to me because the Supreme Court had ruled that it was a wrong standard had been applied, and this person's essentially Fourth Amendment rights have been harmed. But based on the good faith exception, which has been around for a while, we're going to go ahead and let this one slide. But it was the idea in my mind of an attorney calling up a client or having to email a client saying, listen, you won, but now you've lost. And by the way, that loss is going to give you 100 more years in prison.
That has to be absolutely disheartening for somebody sitting in prison.
I am glad I did not have to make that call.
But, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that all of the evidence from that came from geolocation data on cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times recently did a very interesting investigative piece on just the scope of geolocation data that is being collected, not just by your cell phone carriers, but by all of the apps that most people now have on their cell phones, and how readily available that is, and how, frankly, anyone who has access to these databases can go in, and even if your data is depersonalized or anonymized, they can, by just taking a few points, figure out exactly who you are and build an entire sort of life history of yourself based upon who you meet with, where you travel, where you go, and often what you purchase just through your cell phone. It's the spy in your pocket.
We will definitely see some more cases, and we've got some we'll talk about in a bit, some more Fourth Amendment cases that I think interacting with one we just talked about will bring about some problems for us in the future.
I totally agree. Now, let's jump to a different case that, in fact, we were talking about briefly before we started the show, and it involves another criminal justice matter, selection of juries. Flowers versus Mississippi was an interesting case that the court decided this last year, and the court actually said that a white prosecutor down in Mississippi mm-hmm. had violated the Constitution by excluding potential black jurors at the trial of this gentleman by the name of Curtis Flowers, who is currently on death row in Mississippi. It was a 7-2 decision that I thought was really interesting. Sotomayor, Ginsburg, Kagan, Breyer, Roberts, Kavanaugh, and Alito were even in the majority. The minority two were Gorsuch and Thomas, not terribly surprising right. with Justice Thomas. But what I felt was really fascinating were the underlying facts of this case. You had a guy by the name of Doug Evans, who was the white state prosecutor down in Mississippi, and apparently he has just gone out of his way to try to keep black jurors off of this particular case. And Mr. Flowers, in this case, has gone through 6 separate trials for the same crime that involved the alleged murder of 4 people inside a furniture store in some little town in Mississippi. Now, at his first trial back in 97, the prosecutor struck all, there were only 5 prospective black jurors in the, you know, in the pool, and he struck all of them. And of course, then the resulting all-white jury then wound up convicting Flowers and sentenced him to death. The Mississippi Supreme Court actually overturned that conviction, citing what the court quoted as numerous instances of prosecutorial misconduct that were unrelated to the jury selection. So what happened? The same prosecutor tries Mr. Flower a second time in 1999 for the same thing. And once again, he tried to strike all the black prospective jurors off of the jury. And so the judge then found that the reasons that the prosecutor had offered for striking one of them were demonstrably false. And, of course, he violated the Batson decision. Mm-hmm. And we'll go into Batson here in a little bit, because I think you can probably give us some insight into that. And then, of course, that lone black juror wound up being seated along with 11 other white ones, and the jury once again convicted Flowers and sentenced him to death. And the Mississippi Supreme Court reversed that conviction again, citing prosecutorial misconduct, again, unrelated to the selection of the jury. So you really wonder, this prosecutor seems like he's a guy that's just out of control. So then he tries him a third time in 2004 and used all of his peremptory challenges to strike every single prospective black juror, although one apparently made it through after the prosecutor ran out of challenges. And once again, the Mississippi Supreme Court reversed the conviction, but this time based on race discrimination during the jury selection, saying that the prosecutor's conduct was about as strong as a case that they've ever seen in the context of a Batson challenge. Not to be undone, the prosecutor goes back and tries Mr. Flowers a fourth time. And this was in 2007. Again, the prosecutor used all of his peremptory challenges to strike black jurors. But apparently that wasn't enough to skew the jury that wound up including 7 white and 5 black jurors. And the trial, the jurors deadlocked along racial lines, and the judge declared a mistrial. So what happens? Instead of leaving well enough alone and going on, the prosecutor tries him a fifth time. Now, the fifth trial record didn't show the racial makeup of the entire jury pool, but the jury included 9 white and 3 black jurors, and it also deadlocked. And the judge once again tried, you know, declared another mistrial. So the prosecutor went back one more time, trial number six. And this is the one that ultimately wound up in the Supreme Court. Apparently, he accepted the first black prospective juror and then struck the next five. But what the prosecutor did was he questioned them closely. And the record showed that he asked each black juror an average of 29 questions during jury voir dire. But each of the 11 white jurors who were selected only had one question.
Wow.
Each. And the court basically said it was really hard to escape the conclusion that he was looking for, you know, some sort of pretext to strike the black jurors. But however, this time, the Mississippi Supreme Court actually affirmed his conviction and accepted the prosecutor's explanations for why he engaged in that kind of conduct. Now, interestingly enough, Justice Kavanaugh wound up writing the majority opinion in this case, just to go to show you that just because a justice may be on the conservative side doesn't mean that sometimes they don't have a sense of fair play. He held that the case clearly fell under Batson and that the Mississippi Supreme Court wrongfully upheld his conviction. Now, the interesting flip side of that was that Thomas dissented, along with Gorsuch, and Thomas suggested that the prosecutor's use of peremptory challenges were appropriate, as most of those struck from the panel, he said, knew of Mr. Flowers or his family and hence, quote, would be biased. So I guess what I wonder is what's going to be the impact of this case, do you think? Because this is an area you practice
sure.
pretty regularly.
This comes up a lot. And by the way, I had spoken about an issue similar with Michael, Kathy, and Gabe, who I know are listening, so I wanted to give a shout-out to them. We deal with this issue a lot, and one of the scary things about this case is it took seven times for the Supreme Court to just to call it like it is, the prosecutors being racist. Race is something that is so intertwined in our criminal justice system, sometimes it's hard to see. It's just part of the fabric at this point. And so a lot of times in trial, what happens is if reasonable doubt is what you're going for, is meaning part of that is questioning the motives or the investigation techniques used by the police, you oftentimes want individuals that know what the police are capable of. And I don't mean that in a bad way. What I mean by that is police and investigators are human beings like the rest of us. And so the badge, the shield, does not get them extra credibility points, nor should they get them less credibility points than we would just give a regular person. That's really what's happening in the situation. And so as a defense lawyer, sometimes we want individuals who either based on where they live or relatives or family have had interactions with the police, so they know the reality of the situation, that police are human beings like everyone else, like me, they make mistakes, things like that. Generally what happens in Kansas City is that means you want to keep the African-American jurors, African-American panel members on the jury. The prosecutor, however, in many cases, wants the jurors to believe, well, they do, what is being said there, what is being presented by the police, and they don't necessarily want the same type of questioning. And I'm not saying this in a necessarily a, I'm not, I don't want to phrase this. Well, that's what's happening. And so the debate, so what happens is we start trying to maneuver around the actual issue of race. Let me give you an example. So generally speaking, I want the African-American jurors on in criminal cases, usually, and the prosecutor wants them off. And that's not all cases, but that happens enough. And I think people in the criminal justice system would be hard to deny that. So what happens? How do you get an African-American juror off without calling them, without pointing out an African-American juror? You ask them, all right, who here has a family member that's ever been in prison, all right? Well, I'm not asking a question based on race. Of course, I'm asking a question that you would, because of the manner in which our criminal justice system has disproportionately impacted African-Americans, you would expect more African-Americans to raise their hand, and they do, and then get struck for that. And so what's amazing about this case is it's so out there in your face, just blatant, racist, right? He's not even trying to hide it at this point. But the fact that it would take seven times, I think my hope would be is that the case would serve as a kind of a wake-up call for prosecutors and for defense attorneys that race should not play an issue as it's being used here in jury selection.
Well, what's interesting, though, is what you've described is that racial discrimination seems to be just structurally baked into the system as it is. Because if you're going to ask the question, who's ever been, you know, who's had a family member that's ever served time in jail? We just know by looking at the data that you have a disproportionate level of incarceration among minority populations in this country. So you know what the answer is going to be before your prospective jurors even raise their hands, or at least you've got an idea statistically based on what it's going to be.
I was bringing up another part. I believe a Batson challenge can also be based on gender. So let me give you a different, let's take race out of it for a moment and look at a sexual assault case. It may be in your mind as a prosecutor, as a defense attorney, that you would rather have in a rape case of a woman, you would rather have more men on or more women on. And what's fascinating about this, and this might go to more of an unconscious bias, is how we start selecting people based on upon these divisions. And maybe we should start thinking differently about that. My hope would be not only as to race, which I think is really the forefront issue we have in the criminal justice system, but also some of these other issues, whether it's race, gender, sexual orientation, whatever else. Can we push that aside for a second when we try to select a fair and impartial jury?
Well, one of the interesting endnotes to this particular case is that Justice Alito actually wrote a concurrence. And in that, he claimed that this was, quote, a highly unusual case and,
right,
quote, likely one of a kind.
Right. And that's not true.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Justice Alito, you were wrong. Based on me being on the ground here, I am telling you that's not accurate. So, but, you know, hopefully he would learn a little bit from this case as well.
I would hope so, too. That struck me anyway about his particular comment. Just based on anecdotal information that I hear from friends who do criminal defense work and activists that are on the ground. We are at a point where I think we need to take a break for the Jaws of Justice Radio calendar and some public service announcements. So you are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. We will be back after the break.
Now the calendar for December 30 and the first week of January 2020. Corey's Network will have their weekly meeting with a survivors workshop beginning the journey to on Monday, December 30 from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, the City House, 14300 East U.S. Highway 40, Independence, Missouri. The church is east of the Hy-Vee on 40 Highway. Corey's Network asks us to please join their weekly meetings to learn how to deal with grief, the media, investigation, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. This is a workshop, not a grief group. Please include only those individuals mature enough in age to deal with issues being covered during the meeting. Check their website, coreysnetwork.org, or phone 816-866-7868. The Moore Squared Missouri Clergy Caucus will be Thursday, January 2nd at 10 to 11:30 a.m. They will meet at Community Christian Church, 4601 Main, Kansas City, Missouri. Moore Square was created in 2004 as a social justice organization representing different faith traditions, cultural backgrounds, races, and economic means. The organization has grown to 32 congregations and many individual members, all united in commitment to build a Kansas City area that embraces all people and offers everyone the opportunity to achieve their greatest potential. All members of Missouri clergy are invited to the caucus. See at Moore Squared. There will be a safe space drop-in sponsored by Willow Domestic Violence Center on January 4th from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the Lawrence Public Library Atrium Study Room, 707 Vermont, Lawrence, Kansas. Sexual trauma, domestic violence, and human trafficking are public health issues affecting everyone in our community. Trained advocates host drop-in sessions in an informal and confidential setting where you can learn about the full range of crisis, advocacy, and support services offered right here in our community. Contact M. Fisher Isaacs at lplks.org. My name is Teresa Wilkie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page as well as the Jaws of Justice radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn, and we want to give a very special thanks to our producer, Jeff Humfeld, and thank him very much for his years of great service to Jaws of Justice Radio.
This is Robin Martinez. We are on Jaws of Justice Radio here on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. I'm here this morning with fellow attorney David Bell, and we are going over some of the more important Supreme Court decisions that were handed down this past year. The first half of the hour, we spent quite a bit of time delving into some criminal justice cases, and I thought we'd pivot a little bit now to a couple of sort of short First Amendment cases that are of interest. First Amendment is one of those issues that I've always spent a lot of time taking a kind of a deeper dive into, and so it's always interesting, I think, when the court rules on these types of cases. The first one was interesting. It was a case called Iancu versus Brunetti. And in there, the court struck down a federal law that banned the trademark registration of trademarks that were deemed vulgar. And that a lot of people don't know that, but the U.S. trademark laws actually prohibit registration of vulgar, quote, immoral or scandalous trademarks. And this particular case involved a, which wound up getting decided 6-3 by the Supreme Court justices, involved a trademark registration for a line of clothing that was going to be registered under the brand name FUCT, which the government lawyer who argued the case, I loved the quote. He said that the term was, quote, the equivalent of the past participle form of the paradigmatic profane word of our culture, which I thought was one of the better lines I'd heard in arguments. Now, what was funny was Justice Kagan wound up writing the court's decision. She did not disagree with that. She said, oh, yes, that's certainly true. But she said, nonetheless, the law was unconstitutional because it disfavors certain ideas. And she actually gave some examples, which I thought were really kind of interesting, because on one hand, she said when it came to trademark registrations, government officials and the trademark office has actually granted trademark protection, for instance, to anti-drug messages. But they refused registration for someone who tried to trademark marijuana cola. She also said that the trademark office had granted trademarks protection to pro-religious messages, but apparently had declined one where somebody had tried to register Madonna wine.
Wow.
And then she said, likewise, they had also granted protection to certain messages and trademarks around themes related to anti-terrorism. But when somebody tried to trademark baby Al-Qaeda, they refused that registration. And it was interesting because she wrote that, and I wanted to quote here from what she said. She said, the rejected marks express opinions that are at the least offensive to many Americans, but a bedrock principle of First Amendment law is that the government may not draw distinctions based on speakers' viewpoints. And I, you know, as a First Amendment fan, I really sort of appreciate that she wound up taking a very strong stand, and that at least six out of the three justices wound up agreeing with her. Now, when you look at the three justices who disagreed, they all interestingly filed partial dissents. They all, I think, agreed with the outcome. And they agreed that the ban on, quote, immoral trademarks must fall, but they also said that the prohibition of scandalous trademarks should survive if it is interpreted narrowly. And that led to some interesting discussion, because what exactly does that mean?
Well, and what's interesting about this, Robin, is even though, you know, I don't handle the First Amendment stuff, this it feeds into the criminal as well, which as follows. You're giving someone in the executive branch, and maybe someone, a clerk at account, I don't know how it works with the trademark, but there's someone there reviewing files. That person has awesome authority to decide these issues, which is really what's happening, I assume, in something like this. So someone I'm calling it a counter, but I'm sure you, by internet, someone working for that office looks at it and makes a decision based on I don't know what factors. And that's probably, I guess, part of the problem with how the Supreme Court looked at it, is that How do we decide, how is the discretion used, or how do we decide the discretion was used in a proper manner?
That leads actually
me to jump topics here.
Okay.
Instead of getting into the second, First Amendment case that I wanted to talk about, that was actually a great segue to one of the other cases that actually I think touches on that, although in an indirect way. One of the cases that was in the news this last year was Department of Commerce versus New York, which was the case over the question of whether or not you could include a query about a person's citizenship status on the census forms.
Hmm.
And that was an interesting case because it was 5-4, and the justices basically said that they sent it back to the lower court as to whether or not it could contain that question. And so they said, no, you cannot, at least for now. And it was based upon, of all things, the record that was created by U.S. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross, who the court believed made some false statements under oath about what his rationale was for including that question about citizenship on the census forms. Now, the interesting thing is throughout much of U.S. history, the census forms actually did include a question about citizenship, and that has in the past been abused. In fact, there was a great deal of discussion that the questions about citizenship were actually used to target Japanese Americans during World War II and used as a means to figure out who to put in the internment camps for the for the Japanese. But the reason this question about what gets included on the census is so important is that there's a big concern that if the citizenship question is there, people will, out of the current climate of fear that we have over ICE and immigration detention, is that they will refuse to participate in the census and not answer those questions. And that's important because so much depends on getting an accurate count of our population. I mean, it includes everything from allocation of federal money between congressional districts and everything from transportation to education. And critically, it also counts for the allotment of seats that different districts get in the U.S. House of Representatives. And that's a huge issue. But anyway, the court rejected the Trump administration's stated reason for adding it. And I thought it was interesting because Roberts actually was the swing vote on this. And he sided with the liberal justices, and he said that the record demonstrated that Wilbur Ross had not given a full and an accurate account of his decision to add that question. Ross apparently said that he decided to add that question solely in response to a request from the DOJ for data to help enforce the Voting Rights Act. But apparently three federal trial judges below ruled that the evidence in the record demonstrated that he was not being truthful.
Wow.
When he testified to that. And so, Roberts actually wrote in his opinion that the administration's rationale, quote, appears to have been contrived. Now, the practical impact of this is, I think, kind of interesting because you mentioned the power that individual members of the government bureaucracy have mm-hmm. when making decisions. I think the practical impact here is that even though maybe people aren't thinking ahead, it may affect future cases under the Administrative Procedures Act. Because under the Administrative Procedures Act, that is the framework that the government uses to write the rules
mm-hmm.
for all of the federal, for all of the federal agencies. And it's a process that's really not well understood by, I think, the general public, but yet it's incredibly important because those rules are largely how all the different federal agencies interface with the public. And so that rulemaking process is very, very important. One of the key sort of principles of rulemaking is what's called the principle of administrative deference. And that was a case that goes back years. It was called Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council, where the court has held that once an administrative agency sort of makes a decision, that administrative agency, by virtue of its knowledge base, knows best. And so the courts aren't going to interfere with that. The courts are going to basically take the administrative agency's word for it, that they've studied it, that they understand the issue, and that there's a good basis for making that rule. And so they give the administrative agency complete deference in that rulemaking in that rulemaking process. But what Roberts wrote was that executive branch officials, he said, and I'll quote from his opinion, he said, they must offer genuine justifications for important decisions, reasons that can be scrutinized by courts and the interested public. Accepting contrived reasons would defeat the purpose of the enterprise. If judicial review is to be more than an empty ritual, it must demand something better than the explanation offered for the action taken in this case. And so I think one of the sort of things that one of the little sort of buzzers that went off in the back of my mind was that why did Roberts, who is ostensibly a pro-business kind of Republican, side with the liberal justices in this particular decision? And I have a sneaking suspicion down the road that what he may be setting up is a challenge to this whole idea of administrative agency deference, suddenly making it a lot easier down the road to challenge agency regulations. Just think of what may happen in terms of EPA regulations or, you know, FDA regulations or things like that that come down the road.
You know, what's interesting about that, and I'm viewing it in a kind of a criminal defense lens, is that, and you go back to this Batson case that you brought up, Robin, is that usually in a Batson challenge is the prosecutors have to give some like race neutral reason. And a lot of times, sometimes you look at the reason, you're like, really? I mean, is that, you know what I mean? Like everyone knows and then, but it's stated. A lot of times also in law enforcement, a law enforcement officer wants to stop an automobile. They may have a very specific reason why they want to stop it that would otherwise be illegal under our law. They just have to find an objective reason to do it. So a lot of times we are not reviewing executive branch members, which includes all the way from a clerk all the way up to the president. We're not reviewing them by their intentions. We're trying to review them by some objective reasoning. And the fact that the court is willing to get into it a little bit here and to call it out is both a testament to how awful Mr. Ross apparently is, but also, frankly, maybe it takes that bit of awfulness to get the attention of the court. So we start looking into some of these stated reasons and we kind of call them out when they need to be called out.
That's a very good point. And I think, you know, Justice Roberts, who, you know, I normally don't necessarily agree with on a lot of his views, I kind of think he called it on this. He said, in fact, I'm going to quote another part of his opinion here, where he says, we do not hold that the agency decision here was substantively invalid. He said, but agencies must pursue their goals reasonably, and reasoned decision-making under the Administrative Procedures Act calls for an explanation of the agency's action, and what was provided here was more of a distraction.
Wow.
You know, so he did call it out on it.
I got to tell you, for it to get this far and for the Supreme Court to say that, the underlying testimony they had from Ross and whoever must have been just awful, because they'll give them every presumption that they can that is reasonable. So this had to be way out there. This is the aberration that the justice you had mentioned talked about in the Batson case. Oh, this never happens. Of course, this always happens, but it's so obvious here. But maybe that'll give us an opportunity to say, wait a minute, if it's so obvious here, what if it's just a little bit less of a degree? Should we start to think about that? And maybe we'll start using this as an opportunity to question some of these decisions.
That's a very good point. And so for once, at least in this instance, an interesting ray of light was given to us by a conservative justice. Let's take a little bit of a look in some of the other cases that you believe that were also very significant. You mentioned a number of them before the show.
Yeah, when we were talking. So I'll continue on this theme. So sex registration or sex offender registration, it's something that many of the listeners, are not familiar with, or if they even know a little bit, they're like, listen, whatever they want to do, these people we're classifying again, who cares? The problem with that attitude is, first of all, not all the individuals that are registering have committed the same types of crimes. And in addition, the protection of these individuals, the individuals who have to register as sex offenders, winds up being protection for the rest of us. And what you'll see here in this case is you had people, and I've had this before, and we deal with individuals on the list, try to get them off the list, that plead guilty or are found guilty before registration requirement comes into being. So I weigh all the pros and cons of pleading guilty. I decide to plead guilty. I accept my punishment. I go through my punishment. I come out, and all of a sudden, the government says, you now have to register. And you say, well, wait a minute. I didn't when I plead guilty, that wasn't part of it. Well, I'm sorry, you got to do it now. Well, can I go and do my plea? No, you can't. And so in this particular case, and then the other part of it is we have sex offender registration in all the states, but then the federal government came up with a registration requirement that kind of overlays it a little bit. It's still kept at the state level, but I believe the federal government is what they normally do, would provide some financial incentive to the states to make sure that they're following along. So here the issue came up at the federal level. What do you do? Who has to register before enactment? Who has to register? This is those individuals that pled guilty or were found guilty would otherwise be subject to registration. But this, they became subject to registration before there was ever a registration requirement. Meaning, let's talk about the retroactive application of the law. Who should decide that? And what happened in this case, essentially, and I'm giving more of a higher level view, is Congress said, you know what, I tell you what, we'll let the Attorney General make that decision. So we'll let the Attorney General figure out, essentially, the retroactive application of this law.
That's really passing the buck.
That is passing the buck, horrifically. And so the problem with the case, of course, is it involves sex offenders, which are probably don't have a lot of political pull, right? And so everyone piles on to say, well, my goodness. And so the Attorney General said, well, we're going to apply it retroactive from the date apply to sex offenders convicted of the offense for which registration was required prior to the enactment. And the final rule issued in December of 2010 reiterated that the sex offender registration applies to all pre-act offenders and gave it, let's say, a particular date. And that was the issue. There's a significant rule, and I believe it's actually constitutional, that says you cannot, the non-delegation doctrine bars Congress from transferring its legislative power to another branch of government. So can Congress say, hey, I've got this great idea, we should do registration. All right, that's my great idea. I'm going home. I want you, executive branch, to handle it from here. To what extent can they do that? To what extent can I just hand you this great idea and you run it for me? All right, and that's where this came out. And the Supreme Court said in this case is that they could. But the Constitution does not deny to the Congress the necessary resources of flexibility and practicality that enable it to perform its function. So Congress may obtain the assistance of its coordinate branches, and in particular may confer substantial discretion on executive agencies to implement and enforce the laws, which actually goes back to what you're kind of talking about with the administrative side of things. And so we have this push and pull to define where, how much is too much. And in this case, they said Congress, or the Supreme Court said, no, it's okay, go ahead and why don't you guys go ahead and take care of the retroactive application.
Well, that becomes an interesting guessing game then, that you almost have to look at who is the constituency that is either being harmed or benefited mm-hmm. when it comes to the actual implementation of those decisions. I almost have to look at it from that type of an analysis. In this case, you know, the court was willing to basically give Congress a pass mm-hmm. when it came to sex offenders. But on the other hand, if an administrative agency goes too far out on a limb, such as it did in the Department of Commerce case over the census, they're willing to kind of push back a little bit. I think you may be right that it's just because sex offenders essentially don't have a real political, much political sway, that may have played into it.
One more case I just want to briefly talk mm-hmm. about that we can – that's somewhat – well, there's actually two, but I'll go with one real quick. DUIs are a big deal. Obviously, there's a lot of deaths and injuries from people that drive under the influence. A lot of people don't know because it doesn't feel like it when I go out there, but it's a privilege to drive. That's the law considers it a privilege to drive. And so they can attach a bunch of requirements to it. One requirement that state law generally provides is that if you get on the road and drive, you are consenting to having your blood tested under certain requirements are satisfied. There was a cases, what if you refuse a breath test when you're pulled over, mm-hmm. but they know, the police know or have a good shot that you've been drinking, and they want to get those results. You're not breathing. They can't hit you in the stomach, at least not at this point, to get you to breathe. So what do? Can they strap you down to a gurney and take your blood, even though you have revoked you said, no, I don't consent. Fortunately, they can't do that. But what if you're in an accident and you are unconscious? Have you revoked you're essentially the implied consent for them to draw blood from you. In this case, actually, the person that was arrested at the scene went was okay at the time, but eventually passed out and had to be taken to a hospital. And so at the hospital, they drew blood, essentially. And they didn't have a warrant. Is that permitted? And the Supreme Court said it was. The scarier part of this decision, and again, no one's in favor of drinking and driving, and certainly no one wants to see the horrific consequences from it. But on the other hand, this is a situation where we use a kind of a lawful, we all get the reason why he needs to go to the hospital, right, reason, to get in there to get evidence for a criminal charge. And that part can be a little scary.
That can be very scary. And what immediately comes to my mind is I have a number of friends who practice law in South Dakota. And South Dakota has an interesting law that a lot of people don't know about relating to drug possession. In shorthand, they refer to it as possession by ingestion. So if, for instance, you have blood drawn and it shows that you've got THC levels in your blood, because let's say maybe you've got a medical marijuana card and you've been smoking it in Missouri or whatever state permits it. If you're in South Dakota and then it shows up in your bloodstream, you can then be convicted of possession of marijuana, which is an interesting sort of twist then when you think about the ability of somebody to consent or revoke their consent to having their blood drawn when it comes to an accident situation or something along those lines. To me, at least in my mind, that implicates a tremendous number of self-incrimination issues.
Correct. And also, we're going back to the individual on the ground, the executive branch member, not the president, the vice president, whatever. We're talking about someone at an agency, in this case, police officer, making those significant constitutional decisions. And that's what we have to either agree. We have to come to some type of agreement as a nation if we want that to happen, if we don't want that to happen. It may be that the death and injuries from drunk driving are so important to us that we're okay with that. But it's one of those questions where we all need to sit down and talk about it and decide, is this what we want? Rather than, in my opinion, throwing it up to the Supreme Court and like a football game and seeing who wins at the end. I think we need to kind of get away from that, and that's something that I'm hoping we'll see as we go down the road.
We shall see where that goes. But yeah, you're right. It's such a tremendous argument back and forth, and that just really, I think, underscores the importance of these decisions that are being made. Well, it looks like we're down to 1 minute, so before we have to sign off. But let me go ahead and, I guess in the last minute, cover just one final case that I thought was interesting, jumping back to First Amendment. And I think we're going to see more of these kinds of cases coming up in the following years. And that's going to be separation of church and state. One of the cases decided this last year was American Legion versus American Humanist Association, where the court allowed a 40-foot cross honoring soldiers from World War I to remain on government land. The court seemed to be very highly divided in that case. In fact, there were 7 different opinions issued, which is very unusual. But their conclusion was pretty clear. They allowed much more religious presence in government, such as religious symbols on government property, government support for religion. And I think this case is kind of a foreshadowing of a major shift on the court when it comes to its Establishment Clause jurisprudence, where I think the majority of the justices sort of rejected this idea of a strict wall of separation between church and state and are much more inclined to accommodate religion and government.
I mean, given our limited time, all I can say, Robin, is I'm going to pray on that one. So, thank you very much.
Well, you've been listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM. KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. This is Robin Martinez, and I am here with David Bell, and the two of us have been talking about and covering some of the more important U.S. Supreme Court decisions that were handed down over the past year. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
It has been said that the only constant is change, and today marks another one of those changes. This is Jeff, and I have been producing Jaws of Justice Radio for 10 years now, with a great deal of help from a large cast. The idea for the show was born in the heart of Sista G. Gabbiato, and she was our first engineer. It took over a year of discussion and meetings to finally get our first show on the air. Our first guests were from the Midwest Innocence Project in November 2009. Ironically, it was not the show we had planned. Jaws of Justice Radio has always been a collective of sorts, with anywhere from 5 to 12 or more people involved at any one time, and that tradition will be true moving forward. That original group was made up of activists, formerly incarcerated citizens, and folks that just had justice in their heart. People like Alvin Kirksey Bay, Keith Brownell, Macy Jones, J. Renee Trombley, Misty Palmer, and James Boyd, whose time behind bars totaled more than a very long lifetime. Carl Rodney, John Burris, Michelle Dodson, Rebecca Brock, and Harriet Keeney, whose own experiences with injustice created a desire for change. This show has always striven to inform our listeners about the realities of the system that promised justice, but more often than not, just punished people for who they were or behavior that offended the norm. But we did this in the hopes that we could start a dialogue between those who were part of the system and those who were victims of the system. That effort attracted new people as others left. Folks like Margot Patterson, David Bell, Melvin Merritt, Jessica Thomas, Beth Pike, Alvern Bush, and others. I have been the face of Jaws of Justice Radio for some time now, but this has always been a group effort and would not be what it is or have accomplished what it has without those who do the interviews and search out the issues that we bring to you week in and week out. I leave active involvement with KKAFI after 26 years to become more activist than media and to attend to family. I leave the show in the hands of the present volunteers. I wish good luck to those volunteers, Teresa Wilkie, Elise Max, Keith Washburn, Elisa Breitenbach, Craig Lubow, Pat Bartholome, Latara Smith, and others already named. You may hear me again sometime in the future as a guest host, or maybe even as a guest with an issue to discuss. I bid you farewell and urge you to stay informed, engaged, and activated. I love you all, and thanks for listening. Oh, and don't forget to support KKFI during their pledge drives.
Sitting here in my problem, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.